Sister, woman, sister, can you still feel any pain? Or have they robbed you of your anger while putting Thorazina in your vein? Sister, woman, sister, have the walls grown up so high that you can't even dream of leaving, and you've forgotten how to fly? Oh, sister, woman, sister, did they take away your child and they locked her up in some juvenile hall to grow up weary and wild?
Oh, hi, I'm Irene Yarrow, and this is Every Woman's Space.
They won't let me come and see you no more, but I still got the poem that you wrote me. It's hanging on my apartment door. Reads enough.
This is a program by, for, and about women. All kinds of women. Lesbian, bisexual, heterosexual, celibate, undecided, and inactive. Well known or not known, no matter what our age, our race, our class background, or our work. This is a time and a space for us to come together, to talk, and to listen, to explore our culture, and to grow. And it's a time and a space for communication, as much as possible, always, between me and my guests, and there is one guest here tonight, who you will meet in a moment or two, and between us and you out there. We're not going to take phone calls tonight, because we have too much that we want to do just here with us. But as always, I would like you to write me letters. I appreciate getting your letters more than I can say. They were, I think they're about a dozen letters this week about last week's show, and it was really wonderful to hear what people had to say about what I do on the air here and what my guests do with me. So please do write, break down your old passive patterns of just being listeners, and write and tell me what you think and what you feel and suggestions for shows and so on. Tonight, my guest is a writer who is an old friend of mine. I think we have now known each other for 10 years. Would you say?
Easily.
You know how I judge it? Because we met just before my daughter was born.
That's right. Right,
and she just turned 10. So it's 10 and
ten
a half. Her name is Marilyn Coffey, and she is a writer who's worked in a wide variety of forms. She is a journalist, a poet, a novelist, a short story writer, an essayist, as well as an assistant professor of English at Pratt Institute in Brooklyn. Her best-known work to date is a novel called Marcella, and it was published by Charterhouse in 1973. And later on, actually pretty soon, she'll be reading a small portion of it for you. And the book is available from Juna Books in the Village. And at the end of the show, I'll tell you where Juna Books is. It's one of the two women's bookstores in New York City. So, Marilyn, welcome to Every Woman's Space.
Thank you.
I'm glad you're here. Mm. And Marilyn is going to give us a little taste of some of the variety of forms she writes in, starting with a whole little handful of poems.
The first poem I want to read, I'm reading for my own pleasure. It's a poem I've always wanted to read on the radio. And part of why I wanted to read it on the radio was because it was composed at the other end of the radio when I was a listener. It's called Insight. One day, standing at the lavatory, brushing teeth, with my ultramagnetic supersonic multi-electric toothbrush, the transistors got crossed. Words, words, words swirled around my gums, while out of the radio, toothpaste, toothpaste.
That's wonderful.
The next poem I'd like to read is called The Diet. I think of it as my Harper's Bazaar poem. I took it. It was a simple one, becoming progressively more effective until one morning you wake up, the ad said, to discover your flesh gone. Mine went in 3 weeks. Skin remained, hung on bones like sensuous silken draperies. I photographed well. It was the bone structure under the silk that mattered, they said. Anyhow, they made 3,000 life-size models of me before I collapsed, screaming, "Flesh! Flesh! Flesh!" with my voiceless breath. The clatter of bones obliterated all the other sounds anyway. It was a clear day with the wind driving from the northeast at 10 miles an hour. They dyed the skin a rich ruby hue, mending the rip in matching thread where I had carelessly allowed a bone to break through. Figuring expenses, the net was just under $232.50. And then I want to read the poem that was my first major publication, as you probably remember, Irene. Wordlessly, it's called, and it was published about 10 years ago in New American Review.
Right.
Wordlessly, he took me, pasting red labels on each breast, pressing airmail stickers on my buttocks, leaving me to do the rest, which I did quite willingly, rush along the inside of each thigh, press here wherever there was room, touch me on each eyeball. When the labels fell off, the glue remained behind, forming a sort of thin, translucent shell, which didn't hurt at first. It fit quite well, actually, covering each and every pore, crack, and crevice. It was just as good as skin, being quite thin and adhering to my eyelids despite repeated blinking, preventing me from seeing too well or thinking much about it. The tragedy. I fell from a very high cliff, being unable to see where I was going, one, and two, being too stiff to clamber up again. All I could do was stammer for help on my way down. Unfortunately, my tongue was dry, repeated lickings, and anyway the glue adhered to my jaws. I broke both arms, thinking about him. Did I do it well? I love that poem. It has such an ironic ring.
It's really a trip for me to be having you here on the show and to be hearing these poems.
Yeah.
I have gone through a lot of these years of Marilyn's writing. I've been there through, and it's really... It's amazing that we're sitting here now and you're here on this show and reading these poems.
It's terrific.
Yeah.
This is a very, very short one. It's been a long time favorite of mine. The temptation always is to slip into the tattered night clothes of resignation rather than live in the raw.
I really love that.
Yeah, it's one of
my
favorites.
And I didn't, as I told you before, when you showed me that one to read, I didn't remember that one. And it's interesting. And I think it means a lot to me now. It has a lot to do with things I think about a lot, like getting depressed and going into that depression instead of engaging with your own life energy and being out of yourself instead of inside yourself. I can't imagine that I don't remember it and I thought it was a brand new poem, but I wonder if it wasn't that when I read it, I maybe was inside that resignation and therefore the poem was meaningless to me.
I don't know.
But anyway, it's a beautiful poem.
Yeah, I really love it. It's been one that I seem to hit it right on the head and it mm-hmm. stayed with me. It keeps on working for
yeah.
me. Well, I want to close out this little round of poetry reading by reading my most recent publication. In a magazine called Sunbury number 5, which is a very nice poetry magazine edited by Virginia Scott. This is an old poem of mine, though a recent publication. Observation, it's called. The language slightly edited so I can read it over the air.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's good to say that.
Yes. When I crooned on the bench at Bellevue, rocking Chopin in LP cradle against my lumpy gray sweater, white cords unzipped, ringed by a chorus of policemen and interns. When I sang on the bench at Bellevue, calling, touch me, and telling all gravely that the only meaningful question under consideration at that particular moment was whether or not anyone standing there wanted to screw. When I smiled at Bellevue, they feared insanity. Curious.
Uh-huh. Thank you for that taste of your poetry. What I'd like to do now is talk about your career as a writer, because that seems to me now one of the most interesting things about your life is that it's been so varied.
Mm-hmm.
And you started in really, really young, knowing that you wanted to write, and you've gone through so many different forms of writing and so many different attitudes about the writing, and I think it would be interesting to describe, if you could give us a sort of a biographical sketch.
Well, I'd be glad to. I decided to become a writer when I was 11. And
is that when you started keeping journals?
That's when I started my diary. The first form of writing that I did was the form of the diary, which, mm-hmm. of course, was in great disrepute for quite a while and now is not.
Uh-huh.
But my decision then, what I thought of a writer as being then, though I couldn't have articulated it at the age of 11, I'm talking only about the sensation of it, was that there was a discrepancy between reality as I experienced it and reality as it was being presented to me by other people, and I wanted to record my own reality, and so I did. I put it down every day, and I kept that diary faithfully, and I went on to school, and I wanted to be a writer in the worst way, and I wanted to be, you know, Shakespeare, and I wanted to be Hemingway, and I wanted to be famous, and I wanted to be all of these things, and so I didn't tell anybody about it, of course, because I was much too embarrassed to admit that's what I wanted to do.
Uh-huh.
So what happened was my family and I got into an argument about what I was going to do for a living, and I wanted to major in English because I had this secret goal, and they wanted me to teach, and they wanted me to be a nurse, and we finally compromised on journalism. So I studied journalism at the University of Nebraska and learned those skills. It was a good department there. And then I went out and worked in the field of journalism for, I don't know, 5, 6 years, mm-hmm. maybe longer,
mm-hmm.
and sort of switched my whole sense of what I was doing as a writer.
What did you do with the childhood ideals about being a writer of great fiction? Or?
Well, I did it on the sly.
Uh-huh.
I would practice for it. I would practice. I thought a writer had to be someone that saw more clearly than others. And so I would practice seeing, and I would translate what I was seeing into words. And
mm-hmm.
I was always working to some degree this way.
Mm-hmm.
But increasingly that dream diminished,
uh-huh.
wasn't as keen. And I finally sort of dropped it all together and became very seriously a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
And if I hadn't gone into analysis, I might have stuck with the journalistic field. Or if there hadn't been so much prejudice against women as journalists at that time, I might have stayed in the journalistic field.
Right. Something happened. You were writing for newspapers out west, and
mm-hmm.
then you moved to the
mm-hmm.
city, and you couldn't get a job here in a newspaper, right?
Right, right. I had majored in journalism and got prizes for political reporting and had done... worked as a city reporter in Hastings, Nebraska, and when I came to New York with my experience and my education, I was told over and over again I couldn't do that kind of work because I was female, and I was stunned.
Mm-hmm.
I was stunned. And in fact, I was never able to go into the kind of work here in New York City that I had done and that I had expected to do as a journalist when I trained.
Mm. Do you know whether, this is an aside, so let's not get stuck on it
okay.
for long, but do you know whether that still prevails now in the field of journalism?
I really don't know because I'm much, much more out of touch now with the field than not. It's against the law if it's still going
uh-huh.
on.
But
now,
which does not mean that it's not being practiced.
Right, right, right. But anyway, I went into analysis, and one of the best things that my analyst did for me was he kept asking me what I wanted to
mm-hmm.
do. What do you want to do?
Mm-hmm.
And eventually I remembered that when I was a kid, the thing that I had wanted most to do was to be a writer on my own terms.
Do you feel that you had actually forgotten that that's what you wanted, or was it like remembering it in a deep way of refeeling it?
Refeeling it, and also I guess that I had sort of capitulated all the pressures of earning a living
uh-huh.
and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
So that there was a way in which I had forgotten it,
mm-hmm.
because I didn't believe it possible any longer.
Mm-hmm.
But then, when I realized that's what I really wanted to do, and I realized there was really nothing preventing me from doing it, I began writing, and what happened was an enormous outbreak of poetry. This
right.
was the period of time that I met you, and some
right.
of these poems that I read tonight were written then back in the mid-60s, I guess that was, 67.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And on.
And then you...
You can take a story from here. That's all right. You can. You know what happened next.
I don't want you to forget to talk about the readings. All those hippie
readings.
Beatnik readings
yes.
with the music in the
right,
background.
Right, right. And yes, I worked with a musician, and Alan Serpin, and
We did all of these readings together. Oh, it was a lovely period of time. I look back on it and remember it very fondly.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great. It was very good. And then eventually prose started coming out. And I worked on short stories. And then eventually Marcella. And by this time I was out of journalism and was teaching to earn my living, which is much more compatible with the kind of writing I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And
how long were you writing short stories before you started a novel?
Oh, you know, I don't remember exactly. A year, 2 years?
Mm-hmm.
2 years, probably. Mm-hmm. And I thought the novel was a short story when I wrote it.
I remember. A long short story.
A long short story, right. Yes.
And then you started turning it into a novel.
Well, I kept insisting it was a short story for a very long time. I think it was a short story in my mind till it sort of passed the 80-page mark and I began to be suspicious. And I remember you kept saying, it's a book. And I kept saying, no, because that was too much to try to take on.
Uh-huh.
But it was a book. And I did write it, and I don't know, maybe now's the time to read a little section of it, or do you want to explore this some more?
Oh, that's a nice idea.
Okay,
read a little section of it, and just before you start doing that, just tell people how long it took you to write Marcella, because I think that's a very interesting bit of information, too. From the time
how long did it take me, Irene?
Well, I don't know, Marilyn, but I know that it took a lot of years.
It took years. It was at least 5 years. And I think it might have been longer. No, I think it was 5 years from the time that the first rough material came out to the time that the book was actually published.
And I think
that sounds right.
And I think what's also interesting about that is one of the reasons, all the reasons that it took so long that have to do with the condition of being a woman.
Well, yes, in terms of it being a difficult book to write.
In terms of
it being a terrifying book to write, sitting around trembling at the typewriter, yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes. I was tackling a taboo subject,
mm-hmm.
certainly taboo at that time. It's still somewhat taboo, I think, the subject of masturbation. The story deals with an adolescent girl, Marcella, and it tells the tale of her. She was a very religious girl, and it tells the tale of her very deep religious beliefs coming into conflict with her very strong sexual feelings and has that conflict as its central conflict. And, it was difficult to write. And then it was difficult to get it published
mm-hmm.
For many of the same reasons.
Right.
It took quite a while. I think it saw 12 publishers or so before it found its home.
And I remember also, I remember you going through periods of losing faith in the book and stopping and then starting again,
right.
Which I see now in retrospect as having to do with taking oneself really seriously as a writer, for one thing. It's
mm-hmm.
one thing to write poetry. I mean, I'm saying this sarcastically. I hope no one thinks I really mean this. But I mean, these are the things that we grow up with. It's easy to write poetry, okay. It's harder to commit yourself to writing a novel and to taking yourself seriously as an artist.
That's
and I think
true.
That's part of what you were going through then, too, if I'm not mistaken.
That's true. I think it is part of what I was going through, but I think it was also part of what I was going through was in part simply process,
mm-hmm.
because I find myself with the same... I'm working on a novel now, and I find myself in the same
uh-huh.
thing of being able to work on it and not being able to work on it, and I don't know. I think that's part of the way I get a book out.
Mm-hmm. Okay, please do read it.
Okay. This is a chapter from a fairly early section of the book, actually only a portion of a chapter. It was a section that was published in Ms. Magazine and deals with the period of time when, the day Marcella fell off the roof is the title. Her mother sat on a huge double bed. "Here, Marcella, sit down." She patted the chenille spread. Marcella sat down gingerly. Something was wrong. She could feel it. So she stared at the bedspread. The tufts made swirling patterns, round and round, back and back, toward the headboard. "Women," Mrs. Colby said, "are different from men in lots of different ways. You know that." "Yes," Marcella said, avoiding her mother's eyes. "And one of the things women have to do is have babies. God made them that way. Do you know about having babies?" What was she asking that for? Who didn't know what mothers told you about babies, brought in the night by a big stork, only Cheryl said, from boys kissing you, except you have to eat their seeds under a blanket or it doesn't work. But Linda said you get babies in your belly, and it didn't matter whose seeds you ate, even watermelon seeds. Yes. The silence seemed to last a long time. Then Mrs. Colby began once more. Well, babies, when God puts them inside you, are fed by your placenta. The placenta is food for the baby. That's why we have navels, you know. The navel is where the umbilical cord is attached. It's clipped after birth and tied. The more Mrs. Colby talked, the more uncertain Marcella became. What had she done? Said something she shouldn't about men and women doing it? About babies? But she'd never mentioned the watermelon seed, not even to Lucille, Lucille being her sister. Now that is the way God made women, so they feed their babies through the placenta. And every 28 days, whether you have a baby or not, I mean, after you become a woman, God puts the placenta in your womb so that if a child is conceived, if you are married, of course, and conceive, then there will be food for it. Now, if there is no child, even if you are not married, then the placenta drops out. Mrs. Colby stopped abruptly. Marcella looked up. Her mother returned the glance. Both were embarrassed. Marcella's face was flushed, and Mrs. Colby began twisting one of the tufts round and round. Finally, she asked, "Do you understand?" Marcella thought a minute, then decided to be truthful. "No," she said, looking quickly down again. "Well, it's really very simple," Mrs. Colby said, half in exasperation, half in frustration, not knowing how you were supposed to explain these things. "The placenta is the part that comes out when you are menstruating." "It comes out?" Marcella asked, her voice pitched high on fright. "Out? Where? Here?" touching herself on a nipple because that's where babies are fed. "No, no, of course not there. That's for milk. But if it feeds the baby..." "When it's inside you, Marcella, when the baby is growing inside you, that's where God puts the placenta, in your womb, for the child to be nourished by through his umbilical cord." "Inside you?" And why was her mother so angry? Marcella was sure she hadn't said anything wrong, not about babies or feeding babies or breasts at all, except in your belly? How does it get out? Does a doctor open you? Is that what the blood is for and the rags? But where does it come out, the menstruating? Mrs. Colby stopped twisting the chenille tufts and sat up very straight. "It comes out the vagina, Marcella." "The vagina? The vagina? Where is that?" she asked in the smallest voice she owned. "I thought you knew all about babies." "Oh, well, yes, I do," hastily, not wanting her mother to laugh like Cheryl, laughing when Marcella said the stork and didn't even know out of the belly button. "Everybody knows, Dopey. First you swallow the seed, and then your stomach gets big as a balloon, and then the doctor comes, and there isn't any stork, but the doctor opens up the belly button and takes the baby right out. I just forgot about vaginas, that's all." "Well, that's where the babies come out, Marcella, between your legs." She got up and began walking to the door. "Between your..." frantically watching Mrs. Colby's back disappearing. "But what does it look like?" "Well," Mrs. Colby turned, "it's red, and it looks a little like..." "No, better not say that. It's just red, that's all, a red discharge." So it was true, the blood, oh, out of you, right between your legs, shooting out like pee, shooting out like water when your thumb's on the end of the garden hose. Did it come out of the pee hole? She was astounded at the idea. "And it running down your legs, and how do you stop it? And rags? To mop it up afterwards? How much was there? Maybe stuffing rags in your pants to keep the blood from shooting all over the place? A fountain? Dear God, oh dear God in heaven, please, no. Don't let it happen to me. No, I don't want to have babies, so you don't have to bother to put their food in and everything, and then I won't..." Praying, on her knees, so afraid. But maybe, anyway, not all girls got it, only some, because she hadn't, and neither had Cheryl or Donna. Even Ruby hadn't, and Ruby was a whole year older than everybody because she got set back a year, so maybe. It happened very simply, actually. One morning, after she got up, dressed, went to the bathroom, while she was just sitting there on the toilet, she noticed a stain on her pants. At first she didn't understand what it was, because it didn't look red. Of course, she had on her Wednesday underpants, blue ones, because Wednesday's child is full of woe. And that must be why the stain looked more brown than red. She thought she might have sat on something, but the pants were clean, fresh out of the bureau drawer. She peered down into the toilet bowl. There it was, a filmy spiral dropping down through the water like egg yolk going into a steaming poaching pan. But red. menstruation, the curse, falling off the roof. She started to get up, to go tell her mother, but stopped halfway. What if it shot out when she began walking? Oh, her pants would be filthy. What would her mother say if she soiled them like a baby, not knowing what to do, afraid to move? No use hollering, everybody down in the kitchen already but her. They'd never hear her, and there was nothing that she could do but sit and wait. Marcella had read every word of the labels on the Halo and Dreen shampoos and the Thresher hand lotion. She had scratched off the M in Irium on the Pepsodent tube, the metal underneath so neat, much nicer than the paint, but she put the toothpaste back anyway so she wouldn't get caught. She began thinking about how she was wearing her Wednesday pants on Wednesday. She used to do that all the time after Mrs. Colby gave her the set for Christmas, 7 pairs of pants and each a different color, Wednesday's blue and Thursday's yellow and Friday's pink. They were nothing special. She had lots of pink pants. All her other pants were pink cotton. But Mondays were lavender. And Sundays, oh, Sundays were her favorites, white for purity and for fair and wise, with red double hearts embroidered in one corner and an arrow running through. The bathroom door swung open. Lucille hadn't even knocked. "Go away," said Marcella, yanking her skirt down over her knees. "Can't you see I'm going to the bathroom?" "Mother says, what's the matter? Did you fall in?" Marcella tried to stare her down. It didn't work. "Anyway," Lucille said, "you're supposed to come to breakfast, that's what." "Well, I can't." "Well, you have to. That's what Mother says." "Well, I can't." "Well, you have to, or anyway, you'll be late to school." Lucille sucked her bottom lip way in and crossed her eyes, making a Bieberhawk. Then she thumbed her nose and left. So eventually, Mrs. Colby came up the stairs, angry that she had to climb the flight for no good reason at all. "Well, young lady, and what is the meaning of this?" "I think I'm..." But Marcella couldn't bring herself to say the word. Suppose that she was wrong. "Here, look, I think something's the matter." She pointed at her Wednesday pants. "Oh, goodness," Mrs. Colby began fluttering around like she always did when the girls were cut or had stickers or fell down and scraped the skin off a knee. "Well, sit still. Don't move. Don't get off. You'll drip on everything. Here, stay here. I'll be right back." And if a woman have an issue, and her issue in her flesh be blood, she shall be put apart 7 days. Mrs. Colby began talking almost immediately as she came through the door. "Well, here now, I guess you can use this one of mine. It's clean, and later today I'll go downtown and buy you a new one." "What's that?" Marcella looked in dismay at the tangle of pink elastic, all bands and safety pins curling over itself. "It's a Kotex belt. Here, give me your panties." "Well, I certainly didn't think this would happen so soon. And step right into... Here, stand up. Oh, you can hold some toilet paper over yourself if you think you're going to drip. Now step in." Mrs. Colby pulled the belt up to Marcella's waist and flattened it, so the elastic wasn't all twisted. She showed her daughter the difference between the front and the back and how to pull the metal to adjust the middle band. "And whosoever toucheth her shall be unclean until the even. Now here's where I keep the Kotex." Mrs. Colby reached behind the toilet and pulled out the blue and white box that had been there as long as Marcella could remember. Blue and white, like hospitals, like boxes of cotton balls and Q-tips. All that sanitary stuff was blue and white. She had always thought the big gauzes inside were for bandages, in case anyone ever cut his toe off or his thumb, like Mr. Colby pretended he'd done once, but it was only a joke, even if her mother had covered her eyes and shrieked. But that's not what the gauzes were for. They were for... Marcella withered. The gauzes were like the most gigantic bandages she'd ever seen, like maybe if you cut off an arm. The gauze made a funny sound being pulled away from its mates in the package. "Here, this goes outside." Mrs. Colby showed Marcella how the gauze was wrapped so the loose edges were on one side. "If you put them next to your body, the edges might open, and all that discharge would go directly on the pad." "Isn't there a rag?" Marcella asked. "A rag? Whatever gave you that idea?" "No, nobody has used rags since the First World War. Oh, your grandmother did, but I didn't have to. Here." Mrs. Colby showed Marcella how to fold the ends before she pinned them. The front ends only a little bit, enough to hold the safety pin, but not too much. That pulls the pad up to your belly, which is no fun at all. Then the back part, which is more difficult to get right, and more important, because if you don't get it right, the pin will come open and stick you, and that is most uncomfortable, so pay attention to what I'm saying. Do stand still, Marcella. This wiggling around doesn't help. But she couldn't stand still. It felt like an enormous pillow being stuffed between her legs. How could she begin to walk? She'd have to walk bow-legged, and everybody would know what she was wearing. How could the girls stand it? Now, pay attention. You have to pull the elastic way down and back. Here, watch what I'm doing, and stick the pin in this way. See? With the point up. That way, if the pin opens, it won't be so likely to stick you. But if the pin opens... Oh, what if? Everything would fall right out. Anybody could see it. Nonsense. Your pants will hold it up, at least long enough to get to the bathroom and fix it. Oh, so you wore underpants, too. So run along now and find a nice full skirt to wear so the elastic won't show through. And everything that she lieth upon in her separation shall be unclean. Everything also that she sitteth upon shall be unclean. Marcella stayed home all day. She found out she couldn't go outdoors and play because too much running around makes you bleed too hard. You can't climb trees or ride bikes anyway in a full skirt. But it wasn't as hard to walk as she'd feared. The kotex bent in two lengthwise, making a ridge that cut into her crotch a little, but it also made the pad narrower so she could even sit down and cross her legs and everything.